Okay, good morning, everyone. We're now into Parshas Vayishlach, and this is the second part of Yaakov's developing his new personality trait. And we're going to focus today on one specific area, which is the third of Yaakov's four crises in his life. Yaakov has four crises in his life. He, dealing with Lavan was crisis number one. That was last week's Parsha. Crisis number two is the beginning of this week's Parsha, dealing with Esav, meeting Esav. Crisis number four in next week's Parsha is the Yosef and the brothers and all that happened there. And crisis number three is in the middle of the Parsha, the story with Dina. So after Yaakov returns to Eretz Yisrael, he comes near the city of Shechem. And in Shechem, he purchases a piece of land. He does a mitzvah to buy a piece of land in Eretz Yisrael. Then he does certain, he begins to set up shop, and to live in Eretz Yisrael. And for reasons that we're not going to get into today, he does not directly go home to his parents, which is, there's a whole issue about that. He begins to live in Eretz Yisrael in Shechem. And, there was, a person in the city, the king of Shechem, whose name was Hamor. Hamor means donkey, and Hamor means earthliness, gross physicality. He had a son, named Shechem, and he named the city after him. And, when the Yaakov was purchasing the property, he had to buy it from the city. So Hamor and Shechem went into their house to make the purchase arrangement. And Shechem noticed that Yaakov had a daughter, Dina. And Dina was very beautiful. And Shechem already cast his eyes and plans to somehow have Dina for himself. And the Medrash elaborates that he went through a very elaborate plan by making sure there were many Canaanite women who would be parading near Yaakov's home, which would interest Dina to see what's going on with all those women. And in all the commotion, Shechem would capture her and take her. And indeed, his plan worked to perfection, and he captured Dina, he raped Dina, he violated her in natural and not natural ways. And this is obviously a very great tragedy in Yaakov's life. Very great tragedy. Now, where did Dina come from? So, last week we know that Leah had the first four children. Then the midwives, the maids had two more each, was eight. Leah had two more, was six. So that's already 10. And then on her seventh pregnancy, if this would have been a boy, then Rachel, they knew there would only be 12 sons. So Rachel wouldn't even have two sons. So she prayed that this child should not be a boy, and therefore it was indeed a girl, and there's a whole discussion as to whether there was a miraculous nature here of change, according to many in Chazal, that Dina was supposed to be a boy, and miraculously in vitro she was, became a girl, so therefore the name was Dina. Dina means she made a decision for this to be a girl. This was an argument of justice. Okay, now, and this Dina is the one that gets violated by Shechem. Okay, now after the violation, so Shechem, although initially he was attracted to her by her physical beauty, but he began to realize that she was really indeed a very special woman, and he regretted that he had previously forced himself upon her, and he now really wants to marry her as a proper wife. So now, this is a calamity of tremendous proportions. God forbid if this would happen in any Jewish family today, it would be a terrible tragedy. All the more so it was for Yaakov. Why? Because Yaakov had dedicated his whole life to holiness, to purity, to moral and ethical standards, and that a taint of such a nature should come and seemingly out of Yaakov's control, right, it could have gotten Yaakov really thinking about, you know, why such a thing happened, what did I do wrong, what did Dina do wrong, what did the family do wrong. So this was a tragedy of epic proportions. This really is the first real tragedy that the Jewish people befell upon them. If you think about it, what happened that was so bad to the Jews until this point? I mean, the Jews were only Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. I mean, you know, we're talking about, you know, a tragedy that cannot be corrected. There were tests, there were many tests, but none of them ended tragically. Here is a real tragedy. So now, Dina is now in captivity. She's under lock and key. So now the father, Hamor, comes to negotiate the terms of a marriage, and it says, okay, what can we do that Dina should agree to marry Shechem? And the Torah tells us very clear that Yaakov, in the entire incident, very uncharacteristic, Yaakov is very quiet, and he didn't even raise the issue until the children came from the fields with the flocks. It says Vehecherish ad Boam. He was quiet until they came back. You'd figure he'd be screaming, he'd be sending word to the brothers, come on, let's do something, but he's unusually quiet. So the first question we have to ask is, why is Yaakov so quiet and weak? Why is he not expressing his feelings? He was certainly disturbed by this, and what's unusual is Yaakov was able to do what he had to do against Laban. When he was not happy with what Laban did, he expressed his opinions and vociferously a few times in last week's Parsha. He knew how to speak to Esav. He could fight with a Malach. He could stand up against her. That's why he's called Yisrael. So why can't he stand up against these two hooligans? Why is he so quiet? You know, what's the motivation behind his quietness? That's the first question. Okay, now, when the children come home, the sons come home, they're in a rage. And Ramban comments over here that the children tell their father, it's not your honor to handle this ugly situation, and we'll handle it. So it's really Hamor negotiating with the children of Yaakov. So they come up with plan A, and plan A says, if you want to be able to have our daughter marry your son, you have to realize he's an Orel, he's uncircumcised. And it's an abomination for a Jewish woman to be with an uncircumcised man. So therefore, and we understand that you want to develop a new sense of a Judeo-Shechemite relationship here. So if you want to have something like that, everyone in the city must circumcise themselves. And this is a point, a deal breaker. If there's no circumcision, there's nothing to talk about. Now, the brothers had all kinds of intentions with this circumcision. Now, number one, you could have said, they thought for sure that Shemites would not agree to the terms. And they said, there's no terms, we demand that our sisters returned. Finished. And that's what they really were hoping would happen. And should that not happen, as we'll see, well, this will put the city of Shechem in a very compromised position. Because when all the males circumcise themselves, it makes them very vulnerable, and that would be a good strategic position for the Jews to be in, having the Shechem's vulnerability. And indeed, we know that's what happened. Indeed, Hamor comes back, and he tells the terms of the deal, and they impose upon the city, and the city agrees to all circumcise themselves. And on the third day after the circumcision, Shimon and Levi come into the city, and make quick work. They destroy, they kill all the males in the city. They take Dina and they go back home, and they completed the first Entebbe raid rescue mission in history. There's really a lot to learn. There's so much in this story. If I had more time and more classes, we would learn from this parsha how to deal with terrorists. Because this is the first terrorist story as well. But that'll be another class for another time. So now the question then becomes, what was the justice in killing out a whole city? And that's the second source where Maimonides is quoted by Nachmanides. Ramban quotes the Rambam. He says, now many people ask, but how did the righteous sons of Jacob commit this deed, spilling innocent blood? Look at all the people in the city. They didn't deserve to get killed. So the Rambam answers, saying that B'nai Noach, Noachides are commanded concerning their 7 Noachide laws. And one of them is to appoint judges in every district to uphold the other 6 laws. And morality was one of the 7 Noachide laws. So therefore, the law is, if a Noachite transgresses any one of them, they are subject to the death penalty. So if you see a person transgressing one of those 7 laws, and don't bring them to trial, you're just as guilty. This is underlined. It was on account of this that the people of Shechem had incurred the death penalty because Shechem committed an act of robbery and they saw and knew of it, but they did not bring him to trial. So basically, being an innocent bystander is not an excuse. When you allow someone to do a crime and you have complacency and you walk away from judging the person, that says that you're all responsible for this. And because of that, they were all chayiv misa. They all had the death penalty. They didn't keep the Noachide law of that judicial system. And, you know, that's no different today, you know. And you could say, yeah, but he was the king, this and that. Nonsense. You know, the king cannot rule over all the people. If all the people do not want the king, they overthrow the government. Plain and simple. We've seen this time and time again in history. Governments can be overthrown if the governments are very cruel. And there was no excuse. It means, but if we try to overthrow the government, maybe some of us will get killed. That's right. Well, that's what you have to do to keep up standards of morality and honesty. You can't say, well, what can we do? You know, he might attack us back. Too bad. You can't tolerate that. And that's why, you know, in contemporary life, it's the same thing. You can't say that a group of people are free of responsibility when their leaderships are a bunch of terrorists. And say, what can we do? We're being held captive. Baloney. If every single one of the Palestinians would try to overthrow the terrorists, they'd overthrow them. Plain and simple. So you can't use an excuse. What can we do? What can we do? We're not in control. You are in control. There's only so many terrorists, and there's so many, many more. There's millions of refugees. Okay? You could be sure of one thing. If all the millions of refugees walked right into the leadership and said, stop doing this right now, and a million of them come, they can't kill all million of them. You know why they can't kill? Because then they have no Palestinian cause. You understand? You can't kill a million people. Right? And if they all were such, righteous people, you know, say, what can you... No, the answer is they agree with what's going on. They're very happy to see what's going on. And therefore, really, we can't do this nowadays. But if we had a Jewish court, they'd all be chayiv misa. And if Shimon and Levi are alive today, they kill out the whole Palestinian country. They kill them all out. And, you know, to a certain degree, they would be justifiable. You can't say, what can I do? What can you do? You can do a lot. You choose not to do anything and offer that excuse. That means it's not important to you. It's not important to you. But you all, when an Israeli gets killed, you all seem to make a yontif out of it. You know, nobody was forcing you to make a yontif out of it. So you see what their true colors are. You don't see any of the Shechemites, you know, getting upset and making a demonstration. How could you do this? Answer is they were all happy, so therefore they deserved death. So now, it's interesting, Yaakov thought that when this offer was made, he knew what was going on, he knew there was an offer made, that they thought they were weak, they'd do a real Entebbe mission, just go in and take Dinah out, finished. Right? But not destroy the whole city. That surprised Yaakov. Shimon and Levi, they avenged the rape and killed the entire city. So, and then when they come back, Yaakov criticizes Shimon and Levi. He criticizes them, not for the, in terms of the law of what they did. Legally, he didn't challenge them that they legally were entitled to kill them, but he felt it was, as we say, politically unwise. Because now the other nations surrounding them would gather up and try to destroy the Jews, and the entire family would be in danger. In other words, you can't always do what's correct, because the rest of the world will attack you. That's why Israel can't always do what's correct either. Even though maybe what they should do, but then again, if they do what they should do, you can't have the whole world going to war against Israel, because it's not likely they would win. So therefore, Yaakov doesn't chastise them for killing them, but only they felt it was not pragmatic for what happened. But then what does Shimon Levi answer? They say, HaKisona Tasas Afasenum? Should we let them make our daughter into a prostitute? Now that's a very difficult give and take that's going on over here. Yaakov is talking about political considerations, and they answer that we can't, they answer never again. Can't let it happen again. So it's like Yaakov's talking apples and they're talking oranges. So what's going on? The question and answer doesn't seem to make sense. So we'll discuss that as well. Now there's a very interesting misconception that is around. So at the end of the day, many people feel that Shimon and Levi, what they did is wrong. And at the end of Sefer Bereishis, when Yaakov has to give blessings to the children, he really chastises Shimon and Levi for being so warlike. However, we'll see that there is a misconception to them being wrong. And the proof is, in the third source, we know that every tribe had a flag when they traveled through the desert. And that flag would personify something very positive about the nature of that tribe. So what was on the flag of Shimon? So the Medrash says the flag of Shimon was green and had a picture of the city of Shechem on it. What does that mean? That means that they felt very good, and it wasn't they decided, you know, it was like, you know, Hashem, Moshe, they said what you have. Whereas they felt that there was nothing to be embarrassed about what they did by killing out the city of Shechem. It's not a piece of history that has to be swept under the carpet. If anything, it's what we stand for. It's our flag. It's our mission. It's our contribution to the Jewish people. So if what they did was a major transgression, how can you make a flag out of a national disgrace? Can you imagine, years ago, if in the 1980s, the United States flag would have had a picture of Watergate on it. For those who remember a little bit back their history. You know, something that you've really done bad, you know, or Guantanamo Bay. A picture of Guantanamo Bay on the United States flag. Wouldn't exactly speak so well about the United States, unless you really felt it was something they did that was great. So if you have a picture of Shechem on your flag, must mean that really what we did was absolutely correct. Maybe there's a technical issue, it was absolutely correct. So that is something we've got to think about. If Yaakov thought it wasn't correct, how was it correct? Now, what happens to Dinah afterwards? Well, she gets pregnant from that one time event. She had a child, and the brothers were really disdainful of this child. And Yaakov was afraid this child would be rejected, so because of her roots. So Yaakov, what he did was he wrote a kamea, he wrote an amulet in it, he put it around and made it as a necklace, and it had some special Hebrew words written in it, and he told her to always wear it, it would protect her identity, that she's from Yaakov's family, and then the Midrash tells us, and exactly how this happened, you know, we don't know exactly, but the Malch Michael transplanted her from their home to the doorstep of Potiphar, who would soon be the master over Yosef, and ultimately she grew up adopted by Potiphar. She is called Osnas, and she would eventually marry Yosef in Egypt and be the mother of Ephraim and Manasseh. Little piece of history. So it's almost to say, as if as great as the tragedy was, it was almost like a preparation for the future, that Yosef would find a shidduch in Mitzrayim. Because the famous question people ask, who did Yosef marry in Mitzrayim? How could he marry a non-Jewish woman, Osnas? So the answer is, she was Jewish. So God arranges things in interesting ways. There was no Jewish girls for him to marry. This was the Jewish girl, and therefore he survives spiritually. And more than that, his survival spiritually is what makes the whole Jewish people survive spiritually. Had Yosef not been the viceroy of Egypt, then the family of Yaakov would have died of starvation, as much as the world would have died of starvation. So this suggests, this postscript to the story would suggest, that although the whole situation was a tragedy, God built something positive out of that tragedy, which forces us and begs us to understand to what extent what really happened on over here. If it was that bad, then nothing good should have come out of it. So that we have to think, where does that fit into the story, so to speak? Now, Dinah herself, just for all those curiosity people, whatever happened to her? So there's an argument amongst the rabbis. One opinion says that she married Shimon, and another opinion says she didn't remarry, but was treated with respect by the other family members. Fine. So some other questions obviously have to be discussed. Not all will be discussed today, but first and most important question, obviously this was a tragedy for two people, for Yaakov and for Dinah. And we're going to focus more on today is, what did Yaakov do to deserve to go through such a terrible thing? Now, another question, what did Dinah do to deserve to go through that? I don't think we're going to have time to deal with Dinah today. But obviously, if God forbid a parent has a daughter who gets raped, you can't say that the parent isn't violated any less. I mean, it's a terrible tragedy for the parent. And it's everything that what Yaakov was, it was a terrible thing. So what did he do to deserve this? And more important, I think this is where this becomes a very important lesson. You see, up to now in the Torah, somehow we always got out of the bind. No matter what the bind Avram was in, he always kriech the rois. He always found a way to get out of it. There was a hunger in the land of Israel. He found an Eitzah. He went to Egypt. In Egypt, his wife is taken captive. Hashem did a miracle. She came out okay. She wasn't touched. He had to fight the four kings. The odds were overwhelming. He came out victorious. His wife got taken by Avimelech. He came out okay. Yishmael was a trouble in the house. They got rid of him. He was able to deal with all the challenges, and he came out always on top. And not really scathed. Yitzchak had his challenges. He came out unscathed. Yaakov, up to this point, he was with Laban for 20 years. He came out okay. He comes to Ezer. He came out okay. Even with Yosef, at the end of the day, it came out okay. And Yaakov was always able to deal with a crisis, and eventually it would succeed. Now, why did God make Yaakov go through this? Because really, he is going to Masa of a similar bonim. The acts of the patriarchs foreshadow what will happen to our children, and more than that, it teaches us how to deal with challenges in life. If you want to know how to deal with suffering in life, the address is two addresses, Yaakov and David. Yaakov Avinu suffered tremendously in life, but always came out on top at the end. So every time he succeeded in these crises, it would prepare the Jews, just like he had four personal crises in his life, this would be how the Jews would deal with four crises that we will go through as a nation. And everything, he was successful. But and the Medrash really will say, and he, whatever success Yaakov has here will be the Jewish people's success in the future as well. But what kind of success can we attach to Yaakov in this crisis of Dinah? Which wasn't just a crisis, it was a tragedy. She was raped, it would not be undone. So what kind of benefit can we see in something that wasn't a question of crisis and coming to deal with the crisis and coming out on top at the end? It was already a fait accompli. It was already a tragedy that happened. Everything else, he kind of got out of it. But with Dinah, it was finished. Nothing could be fixed. So, and it couldn't have gotten worse than how it got. I mean, thank God they got her out afterwards, but it's a little too late. So what kind of benefit for our national history does this help us with? This is what we have to understand. And to be more specific, this is the third of Yaakov's crises, and there are four crises, and we know there's four dominions of exile that the Jews have to suffer. First being the Babylonian exile, then the Persian-Syrian exile, and then the third is the Greek. The Greek exile. So this third crisis of Dinah must parallel the third crisis of the Greece-Assyrian exile. And in what ways did this parallel that exile? And obviously that's going to spin us into Hanukkah, obviously, and that's why we have coming in, we're in Kislev already, we're only a few weeks away from Hanukkah, we have to see what's going to be the Hanukkah message out of here. Because Hanukkah really is all based on how the Jews dealt with the Greek exile. So if you look about it, there are a lot of similarities to this story in the Greek exile. Number one, the story of Dinah revolves around circumcision. Right? They said you got to circumcise yourselves. And the Greeks in the exile, one of their biggest resistances to us as Jews was the midst of circumcision. They said we couldn't circumcise ourselves. So that's one thing. Number two, Dinah was raped. Under Greek-Assyrian rule, the common practice was that the government official was able to rape every virgin bride before she came to the chuppah. This was the way it was under the Greek Empire. So, I mean, so you could say those are circumstantial parallels, but there obviously must be a deeper connection between these stories, and that's what we have to talk about as well. Okay, so that's, we got to figure this. And the final issue over here is, look in source number 4. We do have a reason given for why Yaakov suffers this indignity. In the beginning of the Parsha, when Yaakov prepares to meet Esav, it says he and his 11 children are there to meet him. Now we know that Yaakov has 12 children at this time in the game, the 11 sons and Dinah. So where was Dinah? So Rashi says he put her in a box, in a chest, and he locked it, he closed it. And he said, why? Because he didn't want Esav to cast his eyes upon her. I don't want that lecherous brother of mine seeing my beautiful daughter. And Rashi says from Chazal, this is why Yaakov was punished. Because he withheld her from his brother. Because she may have been able to make a Baal Tshuva out of Esav. And therefore she fell into the hands of Shechem as a punishment to Yaakov. Again, it's not addressing Dinah's issues. It's really dealing with Yaakov's issues over here. In other words, the Torah is saying, you had a chance. If Esav would have seen your daughter, maybe she would have turned him back to Hashem. So since you didn't do that, I'm going to punish you that now she's going to fall into the hands of a bad guy as well. Now, on a simple level, the Gemara is saying, you never can underestimate the power of a Jewish wife. And just because Avram couldn't influence Esav and Yitzhak couldn't influence Esav does not mean that Dinah couldn't. That's number one. And even if she couldn't change him, it would be worth it to give it a try. Right? But if Dinah's in a box, Esav never meets her, there's no chance at all. So, Yaakov, was not giving Esav that chance to do tshuva. Now, if he gives him a chance, it doesn't work. That's one thing, right? So, now of course, you got to understand. You know, what does that mean? I mean, if somebody would, if you have a daughter of marriageable age, and someone says, "I've got a shidduch for your daughter," tell me what yeshiva went to. He didn't go to any. He went to yeshiva of Hell's Angels. Okay, tell me a little bit more about him. He's done time in the slammer. He's done this and that, anything else. But, you know, they say he's got a good heart. He's got a lot of potential. He's got a lot of potential. He just wasn't raised properly. I think a good wife would straighten him out. Say, you know, not for me, my friend. I don't think we would punish such a parent for keeping this daughter away from that guy. So it's a difficult thing to understand, what exactly was Yaakov's fault over here. Now, other commentaries that said that Yaakov wasn't faulted for hiding her in the box, but they say like this, he was faulted for when he put her in the box, he closed it with too much zeal. He closed it with a resounding shut. In other words, he should have closed it maybe with a tear in his eye. Say, alright, you know, I wish I could have married Dinah to him, but you know, he's such a creep. What can I do? Oh, Nebuch, unfortunately, I'll have to close the box. There's a way to shecht animals. You could shecht animals and say, boy, I just love chopping their heads off. Or you could say, Nebuch, the poor little cow. I feel bad for the cow, but it's a mitzvah. People have to eat. So Nebuch, you know, I'll shecht it because it's doing good for humanity. You know, there's a different way to shecht. You know, so okay, you gotta close the box, but don't slam it shut. You know, you could have, you know, people call on the phone, you know, these, what do you call them, the telemarketers. You know, there's two ways to hang up on them. First of all, I'm not saying you necessarily have to listen for their 10-minute spiel before they stop taking their first breath, where you can get a word in edgewise. You know, I think you could definitely cut them off. But, you know, you can just say, you know, I hate you guys, you're a bunch of creeps, slam. They could say, I'm really sorry, but I haven't got this. There's two different ways to do it. Is that really, I'm not interested. Thank you for calling, I'm not interested. Or slam, you know, or other devious things that people think of, right? The best one is, you know, the best one is, can I put you on hold? And just walk away and don't come back. But there's all kinds of things people think of. But just say, I'm really sorry. Excuse me, I'm really busy. I'm sorry. And you hang up. But so Yaakov, he slams it shut. Don't slam it shut. Right? So therefore, you slammed it shut, you get punished. So what is this all supposed to mean? So we're going to explain based on both interpretations. The fact that he put her in the box and the fact that he slammed the box. So now we're going to give you some insight as to understand the nature of the whole story here and how this applies to us. Yaakov and Esav were not just two twins who saw the world differently and got themselves into a sibling rivalry and had a bad situation become worse. That's how many people look at the story. But really, Yaakov and Esav represent for themselves, and in terms of a statement they make to the world, is they represent two different realms of existence, and better, two different forces in the world. When you talk about Yaakov and Esav, it's not just two brothers who were different. Yaakov represents the force of spirituality, the force of good, the force of holiness, the force of light. He represented it because that's how he lived his life. That's what he taught. That's the way he raised his family. He raised a family believing in God, serving God, spreading the light of Torah to the world, spreading good to the world. That's what he represented. He represented everything that was good in this world. Esav represented a system of, we'll call, isolated materialism, which means no relationship to any purpose. Whatever his involvement in the physical world, there's no reason of why God created any of it and the goal of this world. Esav was creating the physical realms, the greed, the self-centeredness, the jealousy, and everything that goes with it, the realms of negativity, evil, impurity, etc., etc. So Yaakov and Esav didn't just represent that Yaakov, comes home at night and he wants steak and potatoes and Esav wants spare ribs with French fries. That it's a more materialistic world. Their argument was from a very deep, deep place. They were arguing how did they view the world? What was the purpose of the world? They had two different Weltanschauungs in that. And they engaged and they developed by their choices two different forces. By their choices, they developed two different forces. One is the force of good versus the force of evil, purity, impurity, the light that you could bring into the world and the darkness that can overtake the world. This is what they represented, powerful forces. Now, here is the principle that the Torah teaches us, and it's a very true principle, but a very hard one to internalize. If you are the person who takes upon yourself the responsibility you put on your shoulders to live a life that represents good, that represents Hashem's will, that represents purity and holiness, that's a wonderful decision, and you deserve a big yesher koyach for it. Right? But you got to remember one more important thing, and this is the thing that many of us forget, is now that you have selected to be on the side of good, you have to remember that you represent the most powerful, victorious force that exists in the planet. Don't minimize the power of what you represent. Okay? If you are a God-fearing Jew and you truly represent the Almighty and everything He wants in this world, you now represent and carry the most powerful force imaginable. An indestructible, powerful force is what you are associated and aligned with. It's not just, I'm a good guy, I'm doing what Hashem wants. I decided to live a nice lifestyle, which is true. But you now have within yourself the most powerful, positive force working with you and through you. Now, what does this mean? Because many people have the wrong notion of life. They have a notion that evil, impurity, and negativity is a force that in an encounter with holiness, that the negative will always win. It's a force that represents strength. It will be successful. and Kedusha and holiness and good has to hide in a telephone booth. You have to be far away in an uncomfortable corner, and you don't really have to feel that you're ever going to win in this. You got to stay away from the powerful, bad people to be a good religious Jew. You got to hide. Got to hide in a monastery somewhere, because that evil is very powerful. So a person has to know that's not true. That a person, that if you are carrying within yourself what you know to be the true Torah, that what Hashem wants us to have, and what you have is really good, wholesome holiness, and you're caring with it, you are responsible to project and a posture, both internally for yourself and a posture for the world, that you are carrying a force, that you have the ability not only to stand on my own 2 feet, but I also have the ability to spread my force, to conquer with my force, and ultimately be victorious over the whole planet of the world. That's what you're carrying with you when you carry Yiddishkeit. You are carrying a torch. Wherever the torch of light goes, it dispels the darkness. Because by definition, the torch is a positive thing. And darkness really is nothing more than emptiness and the void of light. That's all, everything you see that looks powerful is really just the absence of light. It's really nothing. It's not a notion that I'm carrying a torch, but darkness can extinguish the light. The Ra in this world, it really has nothing to it. It's just an aberration. It's not something that can ever extinguish the light. And anybody who thinks that evil can extinguish the light, it's nonsense. If you know you really have the light and you have the MS and you're carrying it with you, now if you believe it, then you have a certain pride, strength, and confidence. And that's very important, because you know you're taking the force which has the ability to ultimately stand victorious on the top of the mountain at the end of the day. A Jew has to be thoroughly convinced of that. Okay? And that's the attitude we need to know internally for ourselves. We have to believe and have emunah that we really do have the MS, and the MS is power. The MS is light. Light can spread. Light doesn't have to hide. You don't have to be ashamed and embarrassed of your Yiddishkeit, because Yiddishkeit cannot lose. Cannot lose. I know you're going to ask me, what about when we do lose? We'll see in a minute. But to have a notion that, you know, sometimes a person feels, I've done so many averos, I've let so much evil into my life, that I've created such a monster inside of myself. Look at all my drives that I have. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm so into looking at things I shouldn't look into. I speak a way I shouldn't speak. I'm so ignorant. I'm so this. And no matter how much holiness you put into my life, it's never going to win again. That is nonsense. Now, of course, we try to prevent and not allow encounters of good and evil to come into being. We're always told, avoid putting yourself in situations where you're going to have to come into conflict with that. But were we to allow a true encounter between the best that holiness has to offer and the best of the opposite, we would have such an intense positive strength, there's no way the negativity could win. In a true battle between good and evil, good has to always win. It must. Because good has the light, has the MS. Evil has nothing. Really has nothing. As the Chovas Levavos says, the way to defeat the Yetzirah, there's only one tool to defeat the Yetzirah. What is that? With the truth. The truth, because the Yetzirah, his whole arsenal is lies. It's lies. And the truth destroys him. Think of the last time he did an Avera. It was because of the Yetzirah that told you a lie. For example, last time you spoke Lashon Hara about a certain person, it's because the person deserved it. The person deserved it. That's a lie. That God says he can't speak Lashon Hara. Finished. Lashon Hara is a fire. Lashon Hara is poison. Lashon Hara is taking poison. The emes is, when you speak Lashon Hara, you're taking poison, you're killing yourself. That's the emes. The Yetzirah says, no, it's the only way you can have self-dignity is to pull the guy down. Now, if you look at it for an honest moment, you see that's not true. And if you just let the emes really confront the sheker, you would see that the truth wins every day. That a true encounter, emes has to win. By definition, it has to win. Emes has to win. Light always, if you get the darkest room and the brightest room. Now, let's say you had two rooms here. Let's say this room was pitch dark. Pitch. The other room was booming light. And now we're just going to move that false wall. Who's going to win? Is both rooms going to be dark or both rooms going to be light? It's not even a question. Now, if you're going to keep throwing blankets over the light sources, well, then the light just isn't getting out. Then you haven't allowed a true encounter. With a true encounter between good and evil, good must win. And this is a principal element that has to exist in every Jew. And it unfortunately doesn't. It manifests itself in so many ways. A, the Jew is afraid to put a kippah on at work. The Orthodox religious Jew, I'm not talking about a secular Jew, an Orthodox Jew, why wouldn't you wear a kippah at work? What is wrong with that? Maybe, you know, I'll get fired, I'll get this. You are carrying the greatest force on the planet. When you put that kippah on, you're saying, I am God's representative on this planet. You cannot lose when you do that. You might get fired. Who cares? That's not what you're here for. You're not here to make money. You're here to represent God. That God that you believe is so powerful, he can't find you a parnasa. You're going to lose the parnasa because you wear a kippah? Or look at our friends who visited us from Borough Park. They look very ethnically Jewish. Right? And they all seem to make good money. Or certainly no less than the money that we make. You go to their homes in Borough Park, their Hungarian homes that are lavishly filled with all nice, good things, as all Jewish people should be blessed with beautiful jewelry and silver and gold. And they go with their very distinctly Hasidic dress all day long. And they're making money. Right? Because they know it better than the Jews who are dressed more like us. They know they're going with the MS. They're going with God. So you go with God, you have what you have. You can't lose. You can't lose. And the most secular person can do poor in business too. You have bad mazel. So that's not going to make a difference. If you know you're carrying the MS, you're able to get off of work early on Erev Shabbos. Because you know Shabbos is the MS. You can't come into Shabbos 2 minutes before Shabbos. You know, it's a whole different mindset. You're not afraid of what's going to be if this government gets into power, that government gets into power, play the politics game. You're going with the MS. If the leaders in Israel really were going with MS, you don't care what the UN has to say. You know, we only had one prime minister like that. Only one. Menachem Begin, he couldn't kill us. He goes right into the UN. He reads out Bereishis Bara Elokim. He just read it the whole UN. He read the first few verses in Genesis. He read the Rashi. This land belongs to the Jews. God said so. Forget it. I got nothing else to say to you guys. He wasn't afraid of them. Because he knew he's going with the Emes. If you go with the Emes, you cannot lose. Doesn't mean that Hashem won't give you challenges. Because that's part of life. But there's no such thing as that when Emes clashes with Sheker, Emes has an incredible power. This is what really is one of our biggest challenges. Well, if it was a challenge for us, it was a challenge for Yaakov too. And this was a principal element that should have been more present in Yaakov's life. And at this point in time was not. Now remember, he's blazing the trail. When you're blazing trails, things that we know later in time is only because of what the patriarchs went through in the learning process that they had. So we're not, God forbid, criticizing Yaakov, and what we're saying about Yaakov is on his level of what God will demand of him. And the truth is, Yaakov was able to develop all levels of truth and righteousness for himself, and he is the man of Emes, but there's a lot of Emes he still has to learn. He's still developing this quality of Emes. So he has to develop the posture internally and then shine it externally that I'm carrying something that's so true and so valuable that I know at the end that it has to win. And I don't have to be ashamed of it. I don't have to be squeamish about it. I don't have to act like a jellyfish in front of someone else that might not appreciate it. I can go to an airport 3 weeks ago and my plane was delayed and I had to sit there for 3 hours and I go right in the airport and I put my talus and tefillin on and I daven for an hour slow with kavana. And I know there's people watching me and I don't care at all. I'm very proud that they're watching me. Okay? Instead you have to look for this corner and the hospital and the guy should see me that I'm done. What are they going to think about me? You know, we should have half the pride that the Muslims have. It's the only thing the Muslims can teach us. It's something to learn from the Muslims. They're very proud about their religion. Right? And it's a great prosecution against the Jewish people who can't be... We have demis and they don't. You know you have demis. What are you ashamed of to go down in an airport? So they're going to look, what are they going to do to you? What are they going to do to you already? Let them see that a Jew talks to God for an hour. And you got these black boxes on top of you. You know what? They'll be impressed by you. And instead, everyone's afraid, oh, can I maybe daven somewhere else? Can anything, but not in front of the goyim, they're going to think I'm crazy. What are you afraid of? Are you doing something wrong? Ah, but the cheating of business, that you have no trouble doing. Right? If you get caught with that, what kind of chil Hashem that would be? There's no problem doing that. Make a few extra bucks. But they go, who's going to throw you in jail for davening with tefillin on? Right? So where's the pride? Where's the pride? Where's the pride? You doing something wrong? Huh. You know, Nebuchadnezzar comes because we're afraid that there's been anti-Semitism. The anti-Semitism only come because we never were proud about what we carried. As we're going to see in a minute now. Right? If you know you have the right thing, and this Yaakov didn't have it 100% on his level. Remember, he's developing it. He didn't have it 100%. So how does it play itself out? When Yaakov decides to withhold Dina from Esav, Dina is the representation of Yaakov's life. Esav is the representation of the opposite. And Yaakov has to make a decision. Can there be a true encounter between Dina and Esav? Now, me and you would never be able to make such a decision, and why Yaakov decided in the negative. You know, why did Yaakov decide that it wasn't right? But the Torah tells us, now here you gotta listen carefully, the Torah tells us that part of Yaakov's decision, maybe not all of it, part of the decision could have been, it's not a good shidduch, because Esav's a creep. But the Torah is clearly telling us that if Yaakov is being punished by the rape of Dinah, and God works measure for measure now, that part of the decision of Yaakov to not allow the encounter between Dinah and Esav, because of the concept that in an encounter between holiness and impurity, Kedusha always has to win, that wasn't so strong in Yaakov's mind. He was not that sure that Emes could always win. He believed Emes was right, it was proper, he believed in it, he believed in Hashem, he believed in everything Judaism has to say. But you know what? Maybe we could lose once in a while. It's a force, but evil could even be stronger at times. Yaakov wasn't as sure that Kedusha is a conquering force. And when it's put up against the epitome of the opposite, it can conquer, inspire, influence, and even turn it over. Can Kedusha be so powerful to take an Esav and make him into a tzaddik? The truth is, it could. That's how powerful it is. So it wasn't just a personal decision. I don't think Esav's the right shidduch for Dinah. Part of the decision was, he didn't believe inside himself that the Kedusha had that kind of a power that it could turn him around. So it could be maybe the overall decision to have or not marry Esav may have been correct. But part of the decision came from the fact that Yaakov didn't believe that Kedusha could conquer. What did Yaakov believe? He believed that it's possible for impurity to conquer purity. That was his mistake. So what does God do? God does what he always does when anybody makes a mistake. God always mirrors back the mistake to the person. So, as God often does, so when God communicates to us after we've done something wrong, God usually mirrors us back the very mistake and fault that we have perpetrated ourselves. So you said you want to hold Dina back because you believe the force of evil can be stronger than the force of good, I'll let you experience it now. So you didn't allow Dina to marry Esav, which means you weren't totally firm in your belief that Kedusha will be victorious in the world. It's a victorious force. So your posture was a posture. You're afraid of the encounter. So Hashem will mirror it back, right back to you. And you think you can prevent the encounter by hiding her because you were afraid of the encounter? So now you believe that the impurity had a certain strength. Now I'll let you see what kind of strength it can have. And now I'll go and take Dina and rape her. You get exactly what you think. I'll play out your mistake, and that's how Shem gets Dina. That's how we got her. Now you can explain, now you understand why Yaakov is so quiet after the event. It's almost as if after, God forbid, a person has a tremendous loss, he's very quiet and he accepts God's justice, of true justice, that God is a true judge. There's a time for quiet. Yaakov's quietness isn't a weakness on his part, but rather it's a tremendous greatness on his part that he's accepting the fact that God was mirroring back for me a lesson that I should have understood. God was telling me I shouldn't have been so afraid of the encounter, not to be afraid of what holiness represents. And that's what says, V'chrish Yaakov ad Boam. He was quiet until the brothers came. He says, I personally made the ultimate decision if there should or should not be an encounter. I shouldn't say anything. God is playing back when I say, I accept his punishment, and I'm trying to learn the lesson. And that's always important. A lot of people, they don't want to hear the lesson, and they just say, we got to get Shechem. He didn't say it wasn't Shechem. It wasn't only Shechem. Shechem was just a tool that God used to mirror back the message of the fault of Yaakov. And therefore, he says, better I should spend more time learning the lesson and let my children be engaged in doing the next step, which is someone did something wrong. Shechem used his free will choice to do something wrong, and that has to be dealt with. In other words, in God's punishing system, as we've said many times, if a Jew deserves to get punished, he'll get punished, but the person who provides the punishment still has their free will choice that wanted them to be part of God's overall plan, and now they have to be responsible that it was wrong also. So as much as Shechem had only one agenda, he wanted to rape Dina, finished. He wasn't figuring he's part of God's plan. God had Shechem be part of his plan. So Yaakov has to deal with the learning the message that God wanted to send. So, but if he's busy fighting wars, he's not busy learning the message. The children, they weren't at fault in that area. And they will now deal with Shechem as they have to deal with him. So that's why he waits for the children to come. And the children see, his silence. And they understand that Yaakov's going through a very personal introspection. And they said, you know, let Yaakov go with his introspection, and we're going to do what we have to do. So now they go along with their plan. And although what happened to Dina could not be undone, they still had to make a statement. And what was the statement? That at the end, holiness must win. That was their job. Holiness has to win. Dina did not get unraped by what's going on. But the revenge has to be. Because a statement should never be made that Kedusha walks away as a loser. Kedusha never walks away as a loser. So, Yaakov tells his children, what they did was politically unwise, because they are now endangering the whole family, to which Shimon and Levi come back and say, HaKazona Yasas HaKoseinu? We're going to let them treat our daughter, our sister, like a prostitute? Meaning we can't go on living in this world if the world is going to misconstrue and will believe that negativity is more powerful than holiness. And that's why Shechem is painted on the flag of the tribe of Shimon, to say that Kedusha always wins. The element that Shimon contributes to the Jewish people, his personality that contributes to the Jewish people, is their tenacity not to accept the supreme power of negativity. That cannot be. Okay? Now, of course, you have to add one little point. We only can say this if we indeed abide by that holy creed. It's like one little detail. If you don't follow what it says in the Torah, don't accept Kedusha to win, because you don't have any Kedusha with you. It's like a minor detail. It's like a given. The rule applies if you carry that Kedusha. Right? When the Jewish people went to conquer the land of Israel, the soldiers didn't have any basic training in boot camp. They went and attacked Canaanites who were skilled soldiers. Okay, what did the Jewish soldiers come to battle with? Their tefillin on their hands and in their head. And they take this sword and go like this. Oh, okay. And then they died. They killed them. You know, because it was the holiest people went to battle. Kedusha, it was Kedusha going right into battle. That's before Jews went to battle. The Kohen would say, any of you have done any averis, don't go to battle. And what could be, if you talk between putting on your tefillin, you can't go to battle. Can you imagine how many Jews could go to battle nowadays? And I take all the soldiers come, it's going to have a big battle now, right? And Chveis Rav Steinman is going to be the general. Take us into battle against them, right? And he says, okay, anybody who talks in shul, please leave. 98% of the troops have just left the battlefield. Okay, you don't carry any Kedusha with you. You ain't going to the battlefield. Who goes to the battlefield? The guys who really are close to God. Those people will not lose. So now how does this, so you understand the whole story. Now, so this is successfully dealing with a crisis. And sometimes you lose something. You fall. Something cannot be made up. And this is a very important thing that Yaakov teaches as well. That you can continue after an irrevocable loss. Life is meant to continue happily and successfully. Just because something happened that can't be undone doesn't mean that forever life is bad. And if something really bad has happened, that means Hashem is preparing something even better. But what you got to do is not make a mistake. Learn the lesson and don't get absorbed into the politics, into the mechanics, into the doctors, into this. Don't let the externals distract you from the internal messaging you're supposed to be receiving. Yaakov had to learn a lesson. His brother said, "Let us handle the externals. You deal with the internals." And too often when people are put into a crisis where they can't win, they're so bogged down in how they can't fix the situation, or they try to fix the situation, they can't fix it, and they lose the message. There's a message sometimes when something bad happens, and it's critical to get the message, and if you get the message properly, then greater successes will come out of that later. Now, who really needed to show pride? And to show that he will never fail, no matter what the rest of the non-Jews say. Who epitomized that better than Yaakov? Yosef! You see, what Yaakov was lacking, Yaakov brought us to that third meet of Emes. He really developed Emes properly. And he's unbelievable. But that one little thing, but could Emes be a conquering force? That much he didn't totally have. That would be left for his son. His son has some work to do. Something that Yosef needs room to bring to the Jewish world. So the Meat of Yisod says that everything I have, that's MS, Yisod means to bond. I can bond with the rest of the world and infuse my Kedusha into them. You understand? And that's what Yosef did. Yosef goes to the biggest tumah pot in the world of Mitzrayim, and he goes makes them religious. He gets them all circumcised. And now you have to have a pretty good wife who will help you do that, right? You know, Yaakov wasn't able to make such a wife. The children of Yaakov couldn't make such a wife. It just wasn't in the genes. Jews couldn't, wasn't there. It would have to come Dina's child. To make that, sometimes you got to go into the world of Tumah to bring in certain powerful forces to help finish it off. Yosef, remember, what's more important? It's the future of the Jews. The final product is what's important. No, is it a little victory here or the ultimate salvation? We always look at the big picture. It's the big picture that counts, right? Let's now. What would have happened had Dina not been raped? What would happen to Yosef? What would happen to Yosef? He would not have been the Yosef he would have been. Every Jewish hero needs a wife who's equal to the task. There'd be no successful Jewish men without a proper wife. Moshe's non-Jew doesn't count. It was before the Torah, and she had good midos. It was a different story. She converted. It was a whole different thing. It was a whole different thing. But no, nobody didn't succeed without a proper Jewish wife. Didn't. And what's the biggest proof to that? Shimshon did not have a proper Jewish wife. That's why he failed. He was a failed Messiah. He didn't have a proper Jewish wife. Got to have a proper Jewish wife. He also could never been what he, and had he not been what he could have been, there would have been no food for the Jewish people. So God says, that's going to come from Dina. Dina's child, Asnas, who together with Yosef will be able to spread this victorious notion of Kedusha, the conquering spirit of Kedusha. And that's what was able to happen in Egypt. So now how does it play itself up later in history? The Jews suffer under the Greek Assyrian rule, and the Greeks made fun of Bris Milah. Now why did they make fun of Bris Milah? You know why? Because the Jew himself didn't appreciate Bris Milah. The Jews themselves, when the Greek brought a new culture, so the Jews said, you know, this might be an interesting thing. Alexander the Great was bringing a conquering force of evil into the world. It was a new age of thinking. It wasn't your stam rishus. Greeks represented, it wasn't just a bunch of unsophisticated boors conquering. This is already Socrates, Plato. It's a conquering of the mind. It's a whole lifestyle, right? There's a whole intellectual conquest that's going on in the world. And the Jews didn't feel that their Torah could stand up against this new modern power. You gotta be a man of the times. That ancient book, it's hundreds of years old by now. You gotta get with the new age thinking, man. We gotta be sophisticated. And the Jew didn't believe in that power of the Torah, so they make fun of Bris Milah because we didn't feel Bris Milah was important. So that's what happens. And again, God mirrors back man's error to communicate where the flaw is. But after it's communicated, now the Jews see what kind of trouble they're in. What happens? The Maccabees come up and they stand and say, they say, Mila Shemela. They say, we can't allow impure forces to take over and destroy the temple and control the people that are supposed to be the vanguards of holiness. We can't allow that to happen. And even though we're few against many, it doesn't matter. We're going to stand up, take a stand, just like Shimon and Levi did, because the force of good can never lose. And that's how they looked. It's just like Shimon and Levi said, HaKizona Nasas HaKosei, we're going to let our sister turn into a prostitute. So Yehuda Maccabee and Matthew, they said, nobody's going to step on us. No one's going to trample on our Kedusha. We will not allow that to happen. And as soon as they were strong in that, all of a sudden everything changed. How do you explain that Greece had the most powerful army in the world? The most powerful army in the world. No question at all. How do you get a bunch of Maccabees destroying them? Whatever you want to say, you know, you're going to say the technical, the guerrilla warfare, this and that and all that. Come on. At the end of the day, you know, you don't have a couple thousand guys, you know, wiping out 60, 70, 80,000 troops. You know, maybe do it once, twice, but you don't keep doing it. You know, the other side gets a little smarter eventually, right? I mean, you're not Alexander the Great, you know, these great Greek, you know, generals, just, you know, because you're stupid. And every time you turn this path, they go in for rocks, you figure, let's try a different way to do it, right? You smarten up, right? So when we had a temple and a big army, but we didn't believe in the force of Kedusha, boom, we go down. But when you believe we have a force that can't be compromised, that's enough. That's enough. We no more pigs brought us an offering on the idols anymore. Our daughters are not going to submit to these guys anymore. Right? So where do they get that strength from? Where do the Maccabees get the strength from? They got it from Shimon and Levi. That no matter what the considerations around there were, they went ahead and said, we have to make a statement. And that's where it plays itself back. So there was a miscalculation on Yaakov's part. But the truth of the matter is, now let's come back, wait a minute. So Yaakov made a mistake. But didn't Yaakov really dedicate his life to developing a family that would be able to proclaim holiness? Didn't he spend his whole life for that? Absolutely. So even on the one hand, Yaakov was being punished by the rape of his daughter Dinah, but what did God take out of it? He took out of it a vestige of holiness that will go down to Egypt and preserve the Jewish holiness in Egypt. Because after everything is said and done, which team is Yaakov on? He's still on God's team. He was fighting for Kiddush. He was fighting for the light. So even though he made a mistake, okay, God has to punish him. You're right. But within the punishment has to come out good. And you gotta say, you know, everything you built isn't, you know, down the drain. You can say, oh, now that Dina's raped, everything I represent is finished. I said, not so fast, not so fast. You made a mistake, you gotta get punished, you gotta see what you did wrong, you gotta do tshuva on that, and what you did was a lot. You learn from your mistake, and from that mistake is gonna come something that's gonna help you way down the line. Right, so every punishment has the seeds of a redemption down the line. So now, that's according to the first opinion. And the next second opinion only takes a minute. So they understand why even just for closing the box, it was wrong. The second opinion said that he closed the box a little too tightly. He says like this. What's the mistake? So like this. If the decision, what was, the first interpretation said, Yaakov's mistake was that a true confrontation between good and evil, evil might win. So we wanted to avoid that. The second interpretation is saying that, you know what? It could be that, you know, good against evil, good will win. So if good can win against evil, so why wouldn't we want Dina to be with Esau? The answer is, an encounter within one person is a choice within the person himself. In other words, within yourself, you have evil, you have good. If you allow the good to overpower the evil, you'll always will win. When you're dealing within yourself, you're kind of in control of the situation. When you have to deal with your Yetzirah alone, it's up to you. You want to beat the Yetzirah, it's done. It's gone. But when there's two people involved, if I represent good, and this guy represents evil, Dina and Esav, Dina can have all the good in the world and the biggest power. But if Esav throws up a wall and a barrier and says, I'm not interested in hearing what you have to say, then all the good in the world can't change the evil if the evil doesn't want to listen. In other words, if the evil says, you know, I'm evil, but I'm willing to hear what you have to say, then good will always win. But if the person throws up a barrier and says, I'm not interesting, that you're saying is you're not allowing an authentic encounter to happen. If you're not allowing an authentic encounter to happen, good can't win, not because good can't win, it's because you're not allowing good to get in. What if it's a sunny day, everywhere it's sunny, the guy goes into a little hole in the ground. You're going to say the sun didn't win? The sun won, but the guy's running away from it. Won't let the sun win. So when there's a real encounter, the good has to win. But if you don't allow the encounter to happen, then good cannot win. So, if Yaakov really believed what he was doing, and he believed that good really always wins, then he should have said, "I, everything's here. I've got a daughter who's amazing. She has such good. Esav, really, he's a smart enough guy. If he would willing to listen, he could be influenced by her. Everything's right. But the one thing is, he doesn't want to listen." And then Yaakov says, what a tragedy. We could have made him from, but he doesn't want it. Not that the evil wins, but the evil is not allowing the confrontation to happen. And then with it, if you really understand, see, if you're saying, you know, even if we gave the best we had, I don't think our good could influence him, because our good isn't that strong, that's a mistaken notion. But to say our good really could change him, really could change him. It's such a shame that he's just closing him off to it. He doesn't want to hear what we have to offer. When you can know, you could save a person's life. Can you imagine, you tell a person who's dying of a disease, and they say, just take this pill, you will live. The guy says, I don't want to take the pill. You don't slam the door shut on the person, you cry. You say, this is a tragedy. Not that it's such a tragedy. We could save the guy's life. He doesn't allow us to save his life. Because we have the ability to save the guy's life. So then you cry. That's what the rabbis were saying. He should have said, Yaakov should have closed the box softly with a tear in his eyes. Not in tear in his eyes, he's my brother. Tear in his eyes is that we have everything. I'm so confident Dina could have changed him. But he is so close, he won't hear one word she'll ever say. Because he's so close, the good doesn't even get a chance. Then the good can't win. You can't win if there's not an honest confrontation. And that really, if you think about it, when we deal with ourselves, you know, we really have to appreciate, number one, what is it that we stand for, and to realize the power that we have. That's the main message, really, that we have here, and that's really the main message of Hanukkah as well, right? There, if you notice Hanukkah is a celebration of what? The power of good to conquer. It's exactly that story. What other mitzvah do you have that you go do the mitzvah in the street? There's no mitzvah. What mitzvah do you do in the street? Do you make kiddush in the street? Do you put tefillin on in the street? Do you blow shofar in the street? Everything's done in our own little protective environment. Which is the only mitzvah done in a hostile environment? The street's a hostile environment. Because it's the rest of the world's out there. The street means in front of all the goyim. Right? The mitzvah of Hanukkah today, every Jew should do it, is you light it outside your door. Now, okay, it's windy, you put a glass encasement so the wind doesn't blow it out. It's no longer the days you have to light in your house. No days of pogroms where you have to light in your house. You go out in the street and you want every goy to see that we have a very powerful holiday called Hanukkah. Right? As if to say, and we do it at night, to show that the quality of holiness can spread and dispel the darkness. Right? We recreate that belief that the Maccabee says that holiness is victorious. It's a force that is a conquering, victorious force. And therefore, within ourselves, and that's why Hanukkah is the end of tshuva. The final last day of tshuva from the high olive period ends on the last day of Hanukkah. Why? As if to say, as much as you may have wanted to do tshuva, and you made all these promises and all these New Year's resolutions, and you may not have succeeded, because you know why? You're just afraid. I promised I was going to put a kippah at work. I promised I was going to learn. I promised I was going to give more tzedakah. And you know what happened is? You didn't do it. Why? Because you're afraid. You're afraid that the power of good can't overpower the power of evil. I can't believe if I give 10% of my money to tzedakah, Hashem will still take care of me. I can't believe the power of good is that powerful. Hashem says, that's what's holding you back. I'm giving you one last chance. It's called Hanukkah. You go light that menorah in the darkest place. It's dark outside. The Rishus HaRabim, the outside is the most spiritually negative part in the world. The most spiritual negative time in the world is in this month. It's the longest nights. The longest nights. It's all the worst spiritual time for anything. And you're going to take the Hanukkah menorah and you're going to turn it all into holiness. And you know what? Your neshama can't be darker than it is outside. And if you would... Now, what's the problem? The problem is Yaakov should have shut it lightly. Should have said, you know what the only problem is? You're not allowing an honest encounter. That's the problem. You're not even giving the good a chance. For everything that's wicked, you give it all the chance. When it's time to go to a hockey game, you make sure to get yourself front row seats. Can you imagine if you would try to want to enjoy hockey and take the bleacher seats, the nosebleed seats? You ever go to a hockey game, when you're way up in the 5,000 level up there? It's Bamish not fun. That's why they had to make, until they made that the big, thing in the middle that replays all the plays, you know. Imagine 30, 40 years ago, you go to a hockey game, you spend $100 and you're way up in the nosebleeds. You can't see anything. Can you imagine taking a guy, I want to teach you how to enjoy hockey. But take you to enjoy hockey. So here, I got tickets in the nosebleeds. You can't even see what's going on. The guy's going to look, what are you taking me here for? Nah. You want a good drag? You go right by the glass. And I smash into the glass. Ooh, that's exciting. You saw that glass was shaking? Boy, I saw the sweat coming out of the guy. I saw the intensity. Ooh! You know, when it's something that's evil, I'm not going to say it's evil. Whatever, I'm not going to get myself in trouble. And it's an Irish kite, right? We put all our... And we're open to it! You know? But this Judaism doesn't do anything for me. You know why? You're not allowing an honest encounter. I'll squeeze it maybe, you know, and I've had a long day and I'm really tired. I'll come to the Talmud class when you got no brains left in your head because you spent it all on your work and they're half asleep. And in 5 minutes, the rabbi starts speaking the most interesting topic. You fall asleep and the other guy says, you know, this is very boring. Now that was a real fair encounter between holiness and darkness, isn't it? Or better yet, people say, I don't even want to come to the class. So that's the tragedy. You're not even giving it a chance. Why didn't you say, when are you wide awake? And that's when I want to teach you some Torah. I want you to keep Shabbos. You know, let's have it a fair time. Let's do it when you're not, it's not your busiest time at work that you're coming home totally exhausted. You know, Shabbos doesn't do anything for me because I'm frankly so tired I can't, I'm asleep half the Shabbos. So that's not a fair encounter either. Right? You gotta realize what it's all about. So you gotta A, believe you really have a force. A, not to be afraid of other things. And B, when the encounter happens, you have to allow it to be a fair fight. People say, you know, I tried it a million times, it never worked. When was the time you made it a fair fight? I've tried for it a million times, but every time you tried, you were half asleep. So tell me, you really tried hard? Trying hard means you're going to invest time, effort, you're going to spend money, you could do a lot of things. Just anything else, how would you treat anything else? You want to learn how to play tennis. Okay, I came to learn tennis, I came with a ping pong racket. And it was dark outside, I couldn't really see what was going on, and I had a pro smashing aces right at me, and I couldn't hit them back. You know, I'm never going to learn how to play tennis. Would that be fair? No, you go to a pro, you pay them $100 an hour, they spend hours and hours teaching how to swing, and this and that. It's so boring, but eventually you learn how to play. You're going to put time, effort, energy to make it happen. Now you think if you put the same time, effort, energy into being a good Jew, you don't think it couldn't happen? The most powerful force in the world, there's no such thing. Nothing can stand. If it does, it's because you're blocking it. And that's that, and that's what Esav, that's what Yaakov should have cried over. That's what we try to be makar of certain people. You mean to say that, and it could be a little bit depressing. You try to do kiruv, you try to bring secular people in, and nothing's working. So what you have to believe is, number one, you do have the most enjoyable, powerful thing in the world. And you do have it. And you don't say, well, I'm not going to do kiruv because it's a waste of my time because God forbid some of my children will be negatively influenced. If we have a secular person in my home, my child will marry a shiksa. Crazy. If you have a home that's a proper home, they're going to be stronger from this, not weaker. Religious people that are so religious, you can't have a secular person in your house. God forbid what's going to happen. What's wrong? Don't you believe in the power of the kedusha that your home has? Must be. Maybe it's not such a holy home after all. But it really is. What are you afraid of? Go bring a secular person out. You will overwhelm them with the Shabbos. Overwhelm them. And if you don't, it's only one reason. Because they came in with their eyes shut. If they come in with their eyes open, you will win. You have to win. And therefore, since you don't know if their eyes are shut or not, you have to try. And if, after you try, and you see it doesn't work, then you may close the door, but with a tear in your eye. He says, Hashem, I'm trying to be makar of these people. And it's just not working. Hashem, I know I've got the most powerful force in the world over, and it's not working. Is there something with, maybe I'm not projecting it that way. Maybe I don't really believe I have the most powerful force. Or maybe even if I do, these people are like Esav Nebuch, and they're just close to it totally. They won't even give me a chance. But you should never, when you're in Kiruv, think that maybe I don't have the goods. Never think you don't have the goods. And that was the mistake Yaakov made. And that's what Hanukkah says, you do have the goods. And even though it doesn't work on one, it might work on the next person. You could try 10 people. 9 of them are closed, but one might be open. You never know when that's going to happen. Okay, Shkaya, thank you for listening. Thank you.